Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We have a fascinating and extremely important show, perhaps most important show I think we've ever done on this program. But we'll get to that in just a moment. First off, I have to turn to you, our listeners, and ask you for a little help on our end. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your ideas, recommendations, anything you'd like to share in regard to our program, because it is for you. So we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to do that, we have two ways of reaching us. First, the mail, just putting a stamp on a letter. And you could send it to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. The zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you're on the computer and prefer emailing us, you can do that also. Our address is Clemens10@AOL.com. Let me spell that Clemens for you. That's Clemons, the number 10@AOL.com. And while you're on the computer, I invite you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today, where you can find some articles and some good things there I think you'll enjoy, and this program. You can hear not only this particular show, but many shows here. So I'd like you to go to that internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. It's our baby. And again, you can find our program, Thoughts for the Week, there. Let me give you the address. That's spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. Well, I'm happy first to welcome my co-host, Dorothy Riera. Welcome.
Thank you, Father. Always happy to be here with you and our very, very special guest today.
Now, this is one of the, well, a lot of great things, but one of the rare times that we have actually three guests, which means there's going to be a lot of not only important information shared, but maybe you won't have to bother listening to me too long. Well, first, I'm delighted to welcome Aaron Neal. And Aaron, your title, I hope I have it right, Director of Safe Environments or Environment and the Coordinator of Victim Assistance or Victim Assistance Coordinator, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here today. And as her titles may indicate, my other two guests are extremely special. I'm deeply, deeply honored to have them. We welcome Peggy Fry and Jim DeVasto. Peggy and Jim,
welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Father. Pleasure to be here.
And as you may be able to figure out, this program has to do with the long and the sad story, and we hope one that will be at the very least minimal in the future, and that has to do with sexual abuse of regard to clergy sexual abuse. We both Peggy and Jim have been victims of that, and we're so happy to have them here. Aaron, of course, coordinating the diocesan program to provide support and assistance, and we also hope healing. And what I'd like to do is basically turn to the two of you and stop using up our time and basically turn to you and perhaps have you begin to say, well, really, whatever it is you wish to say about your story. Shall we go ladies first? Peggy, do you want to?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. And thank you, Father Ray and Dorothy, for having
Peggy,
me.
Peggy, it's wonderful having you.
Thank you. I was sexually abused as a 16-year-old child. I was brought up in a very religious family that was very active in their parish. And the priests were part of our everyday life. This particular priest that was my predator was in our home weekly for dinner. And I was a member of the youth group. I was an officer of the youth group. And that's how the abuse started. I did not tell anyone. I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell my best friend. It was a secret. I was very ashamed. I was very embarrassed. And at 16, I was very naive, and I was embarrassed that I was naive. And so it went on for about a year, and then my abuser went on to my best friend. And I'm sorry to say that I was relieved that he didn't have an interest in me anymore. And I did not, once again, bring it to anyone's attention. I was just glad that I was not his attention anymore. My girlfriend, on the other hand, was a lot stronger than I was, and she did report it to our parish priest, and he was immediately transferred to a different parish. I never told my mom and my dad. I was afraid to shatter their religion, their beliefs. They were just so church-oriented. Everything they did for the church, and they felt that that was for God, and that's what God wanted us to do. And I didn't want to shatter that from them. So I continued. I practiced my religion. I did not stop practicing. I was abused by a man. He was a human being. I was never abused by God, and I never lost my relationship with God. I felt that God was the one who helped me through everything that I needed to get through, and he gave me the strength to do it. I married a policeman, which I told him when he asked me to marry him. I finally told him that I had been abused. He was very angry, understandably, and wanted to report it, and I was on my hands and knees begging him not to. Again, I just didn't want to open this can of worms, and I can handle this. I can deal with this. But I needed his support, my husband's, and he was wonderful throughout the years. We had 3 children. We raised them all in the church. They received all of their sacraments. I taught religious education. I lectured in church. We did everything we could. Every once in a while, it would start to bother me, and it was like an itch that got worse and worse and worse, and when I couldn't get rid of it, I would sit down and write letters, and I wrote letters to the bishop at the time. I wrote letters to the priests. I wrote letters to the papal nuncio. I wrote letters to the pope. I wrote letters to anybody that I could think of, and no one ever responded to any of my letters. I'm talking dozens of letters, and no one responded. So I continued to practice my religion, and it wasn't until my children were older, and in 2001, 2002, when the newspaper reports came out about abuse, I realized I wasn't alone, and I thought I was all of that time. When it came to me that there were other people in my situation, and they got somebody to listen to them, I couldn't get anybody to listen to me. And they turned to lawyers, to Paul Tremont, to Cindy Robinson, to Dan Tepfer, and these were the people that brought it out. These were the people that really were my guardian angels. They helped us to speak. They gave us a voice. Mm-hmm. And although my particular case had exceeded the statute of limitations, which I had accepted and realized, I still feel that there are so many people out there that we can reach that are hurting, that didn't read that newspaper article that I did that gave me that spark to make that phone call. So that's pretty much my story. And then I met Erin.
Well, now, I'm glad you mentioned Erin because I was about to turn to her. You know, as you were speaking, you know, I'm cringing. And then I hear, you know, well, the priest, you told the pastor. And what they do? They transferred the person, which seems to be the modus operandi to all of that, which solves absolutely nothing. But spreads the problem.
Correct.
However, the diocese has come a long way, as has the church. And Erin, I now turn to you to maybe share thoughts about what's happening at this point or anything you'd like to share at this time.
Sure. Well, you know, I always say that there's no one who's more expert in helping to heal and prevent than the survivors. And so working with Peggy and with Jim and with our other members of the committee, it really is about connecting with people who are in need of help and assistance that maybe don't yet have the right numbers or the right people or the right spark to come forward. And we're doing everything we can to sort of get that message out, and you're helping us do that today. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. I think that it's important for people to know that there is help available, and that all of us here in this room are people that they can reach out to, that they will receive hopefully a warm welcome, and that they will have some time to meet not just with ourselves, but also with our bishop, who is also very committed to reaching out to survivors and making sure this never happens again, that we can do everything we can to prevent it.
And Peggy, through the years, this was like a wound that did not heal. So it was like flowing, kept on flowing and opening up again and opening up. How has the reconciliation been for you? And also for Jim, because I know you have experienced the same. Has it been difficult?
You're so correct, Dorothy, in your analogy. It is like a wound, and then it's a scab. And I'm not the only one that picks at it. You know, there's other people that can pick at my scab and opening these wounds. And it, my saving grace was my family, who were so supportive of me. Mm. But God, you know, he just never let me down. And I told Aaron as well that I felt like God felt sorry for me, so he gave me more than he gave a lot of people, you know, in the support of my family. And God was my guiding light. Like I said, we were looking for someone to listen to us, and when the Voice of the Faithful put this program together in January of 2015, that's when it was called the listening session, and the bishop said to us, there were 15 of us in the room that were victimized, and he said, tell us what you want me to know. Tell me what you want me to know. And it was a very emotional night for the bishop. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the session, he told us, my heart hurts mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. And he was so sincere and so genuine. And that's all I needed. I could see Jesus standing on the front step of the church with his arms open, saying, we missed you. Welcome back. And that did it for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was something where, and again, Jim, we're going to turn to you. But Peggy, just one more thing. When all of this occurred to you, that there was self-blame, or you felt that somehow you dare not say anything because you felt so ashamed.
Oh, absolutely. I'm asking people to go back in time and to try to realize what it was like that we didn't have open discussions about sexual orientation, sexual activity. So it was very shameful. Did I blame myself? I don't know that I actually blamed myself. I felt that I was put in positions that made it very easy for this priest to abuse me. Being an officer in it was called CYO at the time, the Catholic Youth Organization, and I was just there. I was easy prey, and he mm-hmm. knew that my parents would do anything mm-hmm. for the church.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it becomes even more nefarious on his part, you know, when you think about, you know, using you because you were so not only available, but in a parental situation where they just may not even believed what you were going to say. How could this be? You know?
Okay.
Now, Jim, you know, we've heard this heart-wrenching story, and now we turn to you, and I want to ask you, please share what you wish to share today.
Okay, thank you. So I'd like to share my own story, because I realize, too, that like Peggy, she has her unique story, and so do I. And I know that some of our listeners have their own unique story. So I'm going to take us back in time to around 1970. I'm a 13-year-old teen, and I had just lost my mother. Mm-hmm. Through a very sudden accident at home. She fell off the porch and died the same day. Another important thing to kind of put it in context to remember is that unfortunately my mother was an abusive, physically and verbally alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Bad, bad. My abuser priest was in the local parish, which was just literally up the street from our home. And what I didn't understand was that he too was an alcoholic. I only understood this later on in life when I started realizing, you know, what constitutes someone who has a drinking problem, okay? So I was vulnerable in a sense of I was looking for direction. How do I deal with the loss of my mother, especially someone who was not a very motherly influence mm-hmm. in our home? And so I was brought up in a home where men... We took care of the house. My father was a beautiful man, a very stable man through a lot of trauma in his life. And so he put that example in front of me of that men don't really talk about all their needs and emotional feelings inside. That's not what a man does. Now, he didn't deliberately want to do that, but that's how he was raised, I'm sure. So there's the background, so to speak. And so my abuser lures me in that context. I became active in the folk group singing at church. I started taking little jobs, you know, cleaning candles and stuff in the church. And before I know it, I'm being asked to help take care of his dog. And then, of course, little by little, I'm being lured into the rectory, right? And then that's where the abuse happened for me, the actual physical sexual abuse. And this went on for almost 5 years until my freshman year in college when I realized this needs to stop. And the reason why I started to realize this needs to stop is because I could start to see, even in high school and now especially in college, why am I so in need of physical intimacy with women? I can't just go on a date to have a date. Why is this? Where is this coming from? And so I wasn't processing this very well. I just knew that something was not right here, and that I think part of the problem lay back there at home with this priest. So I cut that off. And unfortunately, within a year and a half, he died, I'm sure, of his alcoholism or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he was gone. So I didn't really process this. I didn't share this with my family. I didn't dare share it with my father because my father just would have gone off the deep end. I don't know what he would have done to this guy. He might have even physically harmed him. I don't know. So I didn't feel comfortable sharing with my family. Again, that wasn't something that I was taught how to do in my own family. I didn't share it with friends. I wasn't sure what this was all about. I just knew that it just wasn't right. And so when I finally graduated college, ironically, I applied to the Diocese of Bridgeport and was accepted for candidacy to priestly orders. And I did go to seminary in Washington, D.C. for a year. And lo and behold, guess what happens there? I get involved with a co-ed at Catholic University right across the street. So I say to myself, man, this is really a huge, huge problem. And I'm certainly not ready to be pursuing candidacy for priesthood because I said to myself, I don't want to be a scandal to the church. I love the church. I love God. I don't want to scandalize people, etc. But still, I had this tug in me. So what did I then think? I know how I'll fix this. I'll get married. So sure enough, a young lady that I was dating for a time at college, we kept a correspondence. And then when I left the seminary, we continued to date for a year. And then I proposed to her. We got married. We've had 3 wonderful children. But that marriage had difficulties too, and unfortunately it crashed and imploded after 17 years. Now, of course, I realized, this is what's really searingly ironic. During this whole time, I'm not really dealing with what is my problem with trust, intimacy, sexuality, all of these important things about relationships. I'm not dealing with this very well. Even my kids are to some extent suffering from this. Although I'm a pretty good responsible father. That whole stability model that my father put in front of me, I was able to follow through with. But I'm not really doing well with relationships. So the marriage implodes, and I finally go see a psychologist. But it's all about the marriage. Until finally, after a year and a half, and the trust was built between myself and my psychologist, I said, I need to talk to you about something else. I need to talk to you about what happened to me when I was a teenager because I'm convinced it's got a lot to do with all of this just destruction and dysfunction in my life up until now. And that woman gave me the courage to start unpacking that, start talking about it, start working on it. And that's when I finally, in 2002, I reached out to the Diocese of Bridgeport and Aaron Neal. And that's where I began my journey with them. And I have to say, I was very welcomed. My experience with the Diocese of Bridgeport as an abused victim was very welcoming, even to the point that at the time, Bishop William Laurie met with me and Aaron, and I forget who else was in the room. And Bishop was very attentive in allowing me to speak to him about my own story, about how it's impacted me, what I desired for the diocese to do, and he paid attention to it. And I know from his own work that he's done with the U.S. Bishops' Conference, he was a major part of putting together the charter in 2002. Which is really the document from which the church is trying to regulate and address this issue so as to minimize it from ever happening again. So that's been my experience. And really, ongoing, I still suffer from trust issues. Mm-hmm. But at least now I understand why. And I understand when I'm in a safe place with people and when I need to have a concern about being with people.
Again, another heart-wrenching story. You know, Aaron, I wanted to ask, and actually all of you, perhaps, if you could give an answer to, I'm thinking of priestly formation now. To me, there's no way of looking at someone and saying, aha, this person's going to be an abuser. I presume. And apparently there's no real cure, I guess, for all of this. But what does the responsibility fall on the individual to say, you know something, I got a real problem with these tendencies or these attractions? Or what needs to happen in priestly formation, I guess is what I'm wondering. And I don't know if there's an answer to that.
Well, I think I can speak a little bit about at least our prevention program, because I think a part of what we try to get everybody in our diocese on board with is to understand a little bit about the problem. And the more we can understand some of these early warning signs and offenders, the people who actually commit this crime, the better we are to be able to speak about it and to talk to children about it and to also be able to report early concerns, so that if there is something that stands out that might be a sign that a person could be harming children or might just have some boundary issues surrounding physical contact with others, and it might be adults or children, and that is stopped at that level. That's the hope, is that a person who may have early signs of this, that really is something we can address at the earliest possible time. And if the person, you really can't tell by looking at someone. You never can. And we all grew up with learning stranger danger. We all thought that the person that was unsafe was someone who looked a little scary or was someone we didn't know. And what we found is that over the years, with a lot of research, the majority of people who commit this crime are people that look like me and they look like you. They're women, they are men, they can be young when they start, they can be 8 or 9 years old when they begin to abuse, and there's no age to it. So it's very difficult to use any type of physical profile to determine safe or unsafe. So we work hard to train both the children and the adults to sort of change our thinking about that and try to look at the behavior, what we expect in terms of boundaries with children. We have very specific rules and standards that are new for a lot of people, and it takes some time for people to get used mm-hmm. to behaving that way so that they can create that safe environment.
You know, when Peggy was talking, and even Jim, because Jim, I think the rectory became like a home for you, a home that you needed so much.
Yes.
And I could relate so much to you, because years past, we have to put it into context, my family felt the same way, my mother. The church, the nuns and the priest were above the lay people always. The priest and the nuns could do no wrong. That's how I was brought up also.
Absolutely.
So I can understand how these people could take advantage of that situation. My mother thought that priest walked in on water.
Exactly.
Because that was the way we viewed the church at that time.
Exactly, and that was one of the reasons why I had to stop and think, if I told them, not only would I shatter their beliefs, but would they even believe me?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aaron, we talk about safe environment today for the, let's say, Diocese of Bridgeport, where you operate. You are not speaking only of priests, but you include, like, everyone who's involved with working for a parish or any church-oriented organization. Is that it?
That's correct. We actually, our requirements in our diocese is that any adult who works or volunteers in any capacity, and they may work with children, they may not work with children, but they might just be in the presence of a parish enough to have access to children. Even if their work does not bring them directly in contact with them routinely, they still must go through something called Virtus training, which is this awareness training. It's 3 hours. It's comprehensive. Peggy could certainly share a little bit about what she, you know, her reactions and observations were. And I think that's so critical, is hearing from her and from Jim. Mm-hmm. The result of this is that people walk away learning about those warning signs that I mentioned. And they're not just walking away with the warning signs, but how to report it. Because I think what was missing oftentimes is people might have had a suspicion or a concern in the past, but they really didn't know what to do with it, or they didn't really know what they were seeing, and that was always a fear of being wrong. And so understanding how to report is so important, and that is exactly what we do at that training.
The Virtus training, I was asked to write a paragraph that would be announced at the beginning of a Virtus training or during a Virtus training or at the end. And I did that, and then Erin realized that I had to go through the Virtus training myself before I was able to do this. So I did, and my eyes were opened. Mm-hmm. It is so impacting. It is a wonderful, wonderful program. It just brings awareness. It makes you look at somebody's their ulterior motives that they might have. It's a wonderful program. And I've enjoyed speaking at it. The feedback is that the people do like to be able to see the face of someone who has been abused, and rather than reading their stories or hearing them, to actually see their face.
Yes, I've taught the Virtus at St. Michael's Church, and I can, you know, relate to what Erin is saying, that it's not only clergy or religious, it goes to family members. Right. It mm-hmm. extends beyond the realms of the Catholic Church, because sexual abuse, usually it's the person closest to you that is doing the abuse, a grandparent, a parent, an uncle. So sometimes we tend to forget that children need to be aware of what is good and what is not good.
And the unfortunate thing is sometimes the children are they're too young to be aware, yeah. So they need others to be their mouthpiece, their eyes mm-hmm. and their mouthpiece.
Let me, before we run out of time, tell me about an event going on in the diocese happening in October.
To share that, Jim?
Sure. We have a Mass of Hope and Healing that's going to occur on Sunday, October 29th at 2 p.m. at St. Anthony in Fairfield. And we're really excited about this because this is the second of events that we as the Survivors Committee, along with the Bishop and Erin and others at the Diocese of Bridgeport, are now going to sponsor as an outreach to those who have been impacted in any way. Mm-hmm. Not just us who are survivors, but family members. Even the average person in the pew who has never been exposed to any of this but has been impacted by just the sheer,
enormity
of sexual abuse.
So thank you very, very much. Words can't express how much admiration and thanksgiving I feel for you coming here, making this entire topic known a little bit better for our listeners. To our listeners, thank you. I do wish everyone a great week ahead. God bless.